The American History Podcast, Episode 12, Religion and Politics in New England.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
And I just want to thank you for coming along for the ride. It's been a fun journey so far, and I can't wait to see how the show grows and progresses. So thank you very much. As usual, if you like the show, please stop by iTunes and give us a review. The good reviews help other people to find the show, and it is greatly appreciated. Also, if you have any questions or comments, you can email me. The email address is Sean, S-H-A-W-N, at theamericanhistorypodcast.com. Okay, so today we will be discussing the relationship between religion and politics in New England during the colonial period. Specifically, the Massachusetts Bay Colony is our focus. Now, in the MBC, as I call it just for ease of use here, our office holding was open to all free adult males, which was about two-fifths of the population belonging to the Puritan congregations. This immediately brings up the question, just how democratic was the MBC? The common misconception that I find is that New England was extremely democratic, whilst other regions, especially the South, was less so. I think you can tell that it was democratic so long as you were a member of the club being the Congregational Church. Having said that, if you compared New England to England or France at the time, the percentage of eligible office holders was greater in the MBC. So as always, it simply depends on the context. Compared to the modern United States, New England was not all that democratic. But if you compare it, like I said, to England in the 17th century, then the MBC comes out on top. Now, I've mentioned the Congregational Church briefly, so let's delve deeper into that organization. As a part of American history, the Congregational Churches have had an important effect on the religious and political history of the country. It has also had an effect on the educational establishment, as universities such as Harvard and Yale were originally created to train congregational clergy. The Congregationalists also had influence on the first and second Great Awakenings, and they were the early promoters of the 19th century missionary movement. Eventually, the Puritan churches in New England collectively grew into the Congregational Church. Historian James F. Cooper notes, Congregationalism helped to instill the political culture in Massachusetts with important ideas, such as adherence to fundamental or higher laws, strict limits on all human authority, and the idea of local self-government. Now, eventually, Puritan churches grew collectively into the entity known as the Congregational Church. Each community organized a church of believers, those who were considered to be among the elect, and could give the other members a testimony of their conversion experience. Each church was based upon a covenant, a written agreement that each member signed and agreed to uphold the principles of the church. Now, the idea was that they would not only abide by the principles, but they would be guided by scripture in their decision-making process. Further, each congregation was a separate entity, and they were expected to elect officers and basically manage their own affairs. Now, as for the actual politics, in 1631, Puritan men gained the right to vote. The vote only extended to believers. Non-religious men and all women were not given the chance to vote. Having said that, this is still a revolutionary idea. Instead of decision-making being in the hands of a few elite families, you get the start of modern ideas on voting being a right that should be extended to all. Now, as for the decision-making process itself, town hall meetings emerge as the centerpiece of the New England town and as a staple of democracy in the region. Town governments allowed all male property holders and, at other times, other residents to vote and publicly discuss the issues, which were decided upon by majority rule, basically a show of hands in favor of the measure. Now, what was the purpose of government according to the Puritans? The purpose was to enforce God's laws, also known as covenant theology. And we're not going to get into covenant theology, it's quite complicated. But basically, it's a framework for biblical interpretation, something which the Puritans were quite concerned with, as were all Protestants. Now, I know I mentioned democracy just a moment ago, but realize that the provincial government under Governor Winthrop was not a democracy. Firstly, only Puritans, or the visible saints, could be free men, and only free men could vote. So, you should be aware of that, and don't think they were allowing just anyone to vote, even if the person was male. They had to be Puritan. Secondly, the governor himself hated the idea of democracy and distrusted anyone who was not a Puritan. Third, the Congregational Church was established. By that, it meant that it's tied into the government, and all believers were required to pay taxes to the government-supported church. Fourth, anyone who was a religious dissenter was punished. New England was the least tolerant colony with regards to religious freedom. Now, as for the leadership and its tactics, they controlled the membership by conducting public interrogations of anyone who claimed to have a conversion experience. Oddly, John Cotton, the preeminent minister and theologian in the colony, was devoted to defending the government's duty to enforce religious rules on the one hand, yet at the same time advocated a civil government. In other words, a government that wasn't necessarily religious. Also of note is the fact that the clergymen were not allowed to hold political office. So while government and religion were tied together, there was already the start of a division or a separation between the two. That brings us to how the congregation operated day to day, so to speak. A congregation could hire and fire ministers and set the salaries of the clergy. This was not in the hands of government. Puritans had, in fact, learned their lesson in England when they suffered at the hands of the political Anglican clergy in England. They were not about to suffer under such a regime anytime soon. Interestingly, or interesting to me, was something called the Cambridge Platform in 1648. This was the four Puritan colonies, the NBC, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven, organizing a congregational form of church government. And the significance of this is that the congregational church became more uniform throughout New England, and this meant you had an increase in religious identity, or in regional identity, throughout much of the New England area. And one thing that we've not really explored, but I did just mention, is the idea of religious dissenters. It might appear that everyone was on the same page and pulling in the same direction, so to speak, but nothing could be further from the truth. First, Quakers, who believe in an inner light and not in theology, flouted the authority of the Puritan clergy and ended up being persecuted. Just on a side note, the Quakers are my kind of people. Flouting the authorities and marching to the beat of your own drum is right up my alley. Apparently so is being persecuted, but that's a story for another day. Sadly, some Quakers were actually executed publicly. Now, also along the same lines of dissenters, you have Anne Hutchinson. She believed in something called antinomianism. She argued and promulgated the idea that the elect didn't need to obey the laws of man. They were predestined for salvation. So what's the point in obeying the laws of men? You're predestined to go to heaven. It's already been decided. That's not where her radical ideas ended, however. She also had the audacity to hold prayer meetings at her house to discuss the sermons of John Cotton with other women. Now, this was taboo for someone who was not a member of the clergy. Thus, she was accused of heresy, or wrong practice, and brought to trial in 1638. Now, in the trial, Anne claimed she had direct revelation from God. This made it even worse, as this is considered an even more grievous heresy. So she's a heretic on two counts. Basically, she's banned from the colony, and she sets out for Rhode Island. It is believed today that her trial might have been politically motivated, since some who supported Anne politically opposed the present leadership of the colony. And so that brings us to Roger Williams. He was an extreme separatist who challenged the legality of Plymouth and the NBC's charters because the land had belonged previously to Native Americans, and it was not the king's land to grant. He claimed the NBC took the land from the Indians without fair compensation. Williams argued he was governed by liberty of conscience, or the freedom to allow or to follow one's own ethical and religious beliefs. Further, he claimed the government could only punish civil crimes, while it was the responsibility of the church to enforce religious discipline. He also argued that no man should be forced to go to church, in effect, challenging the basis of the NBC's government. Now, this phrase would later be used by Jefferson in the 19th century, and it is somewhat controversial today. I'm not a scholar of Jefferson, so I'm treading lightly here, but this idea of the separation of church and state is picked up upon by Jefferson when he says there should be no establishment of religion or the practice thereof. And so again, I'm treading very lightly here, but I will say that everyone seems to focus on the first part of that phrase, the no establishment of religion part of the phrase, and they ignore the second half, which is, or the practice thereof. You cannot interfere with the practice of religion. The General Court banished Roger Williams from the colony, as it turns out, in October of 1635, and he fled in the winter of 1636 to Narragansett Bay, where he was sheltered by some Native American friends. He then purchased land from American Indians, and he founded the colony, or the community of Providence, accepting all settlers regardless of their belief. Now, as you can probably imagine, Puritanism begins to decline. The first generation of Puritans began losing their zeal as time went on. Firstly, a large population influx dispersed the Puritan population into or onto outlying farms and away from the control of the church and the neighbors. After the wave of dissension of the 1630s and 40s, conversions decreased dramatically. Children of non-converted members could not be baptized, and so there was kind of a built-in problem with the religion. They're kind of going to make themselves obsolete or scarce, if you will. Also, the jeremiad taken from the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah was used by preachers to scold parishioners into becoming more committed to their faith. Conversions continued to abate as second-generation Puritans would have trouble getting their conversions authenticated by the church, thus preventing their children from being baptized. Now, in response, in 1662, the Puritans create the Halfway Covenant. This sought to attract more members by giving partial membership to the unconverted. The children of the Halfway members were allowed to be baptized. In other words, the leadership realized there was a built-in mechanism that was causing church numbers to decline, and they tried to reverse that trend. By 1700, the Puritan churches opened baptism to anyone who wanted it. And further effects of this was the distinction between the elect and other members of society began to subside. At this point, strict religious purity was sacrificed for wider participation, and women made up a larger percentage of their congregations. And finally, the decline of Puritanism and the power of the clergy can be seen or symbolized by the Salem witch trials of 1692. As a matter of context, Massachusetts was suffering political, religious, and military upheaval that caused widespread paranoia and unrest. Many Europeans and colonists in the 16th and the 17th centuries believed that the devil worked through witches in the real world. The first accusations started when some young girls, after listening to voodoo tales from an African servant, started acting strange. The witch hunt then resulted in a reign of terror after certain older women were accused of being witches. These accusers, these young females, were from the poor western part of the community, and they were accusing the more prosperous people in the east. So there might have been some political motivations behind all this. But after the trials, 20 people were executed, as was a dog. Cotton Mather, one of the most prominent clergymen in Massachusetts tacitly supported the witch trials, and this tended to add to the weakening of the clergy and their prestige. Okay, well, I know this was kind of a short episode, but my goal has been to really keep these to 15 to 20 minutes, and this one we're right at 15 minutes, so that's it for now. I hope you found it fascinating and enlightening. Next time, we will discuss the relations between the settlers and the Indians in New England. And I'm sure that we, meaning me, will bust some myths and some misconceptions that you have about the way New Englanders treated Native Americans. As always, feel free to visit the website and sign up for email updates. You can also find me on Twitter, at AmericanHisCast. And, of course, I mentioned my email earlier, Sean@theAmericanHistoryPodcast.com. Until next time, have a great day.